The third party debate, opposing views and obstacles to electoral success, the Right Podcast. I don't know about you, but I have received my mail-in ballot and I have officially voted. So a question that comes up all throughout anybody somewhat left of center is how to address voting. Should we not vote and just simply not partake in this electoral system? Should we vote third party? Should we vote Democrat? Should we write in a candidate? This video is going to discuss pro-democratic voices, pro-third party voices, and look at some of the obstacles that third parties face when it comes to electoral success, ranging from campaign finance reform to just the basic way that the House and Senate function. Let's check it out. Video overview. We'll go through the introduction, which is this. Can third parties even win? Maybe the first thing to address. Is this even possible? We'll talk about campaign finance reform and what that means to the electoral process in the United States. Then we'll talk about what happens if third parties win. You know, if someone gets elected to the House of Representatives or the Senate or the executive branch, could they even govern or make a difference? Then we're going to look at two interviews, one interview from a pro-Democrat voice, one interview from a pro-third party voice, and then we will wrap this up with conclusions. I'm sure that you are all familiar with the cyclical third party debate. This occurs all over social media. This occurs all over traditional media. This occurs all over your interactions with your friends, regardless of what side you fall on. And it goes something like this, right? Some voters are disenfranchised by the party in power. However, the opposing party is equally as bad and offers little to inspire votes. Some voters look elsewhere, such as third parties or write-in candidates. The duopoly of Democrats and Republicans criticize third-party voters for them losing. People vote for one of the major parties after listening to the duopoly, and then some voters become disenfranchised by the party in power. There's some legitimacy to this, and there's a lot of grifting to this. There are people on Twitter, for instance, that make a living just talking about this because it's not necessarily something that's going to end anytime soon, and it's profitable to, you know, make money off of grievance. But there is legitimate grievance in this, and we're going to look at both sides of this. Whether that side be, this is the system we have, and the best way to accomplish it is to push Democrats to the left, maybe Bernie Sanders' message, as well as the third party message saying, you cannot push these parties to the left or maybe, you know, other ways, because this is who they fundamentally are, and they are never going to listen to you, but they will criticize you and make you feel bad and force you to vote for them. Boilerplate reasons to vote third party. So these are some of the most common reasons, I believe, that people vote third party. Things will never change until more parties get involved. Makes sense. If a third party gets 5% of the general election vote, they get federal funding. This is something echoed by the Green Party, for instance. A vote for a lesser evil is still a vote for evil. And I have said that in past iterations of this life that I have. In transparency, I voted for third parties and Democrats. I canvassed for Ralph Nader in the Al Gore, the infamous now Al Gore Bush hanging Chad election. And I don't have a hard stance on either. I have learned to begin listening instead of telling people what to do. But this is something that I myself have said. The duopoly serves the same moneyed interests and not the people. Whether it's Republicans or whether it's Democrats, at the end of the day, it's all just big money corporations and they don't care about you. Third parties can greatly impact election results, which could force major parties to adopt policies or enter into coalition. This has two parts to it, and one harkens back to a much simpler time, a time when I focused on history and civics for high school students. the first part of this would be that there's this idea in at least textbooks around 2005 before, if you're in civics or social studies class, government, whatever they call it, that third parties do serve a purpose, but that they're watchdog parties, that essentially they're not there to really win anything, but they're there to keep the Democrats and Republicans in line, and that they usually run on some type of policy. And back then it was mostly things like the environment, if we're talking about the Green Party. Today it could be Medicare for all, right? So the purpose was, as a watchdog, to kind of force the major parties to adopt these policies and receive valid criticism. Now, there's another part of this too, if we're talking about coalition, and this has more to do with parliamentary politics than what we've seen in our presidential system and in our bicameral legislative system, in that there is also the idea that if you get enough people into the House or the Senate, for instance, that you could force maybe the Democrats to enter into a coalition with the Green Party or any third party that you would like to bring up. The idea being that this third party could potentially block legislation from moving forward, forcing a major party, maybe it's the Republicans and the Libertarian Party, to include policies or even potentially elevate members of that party who are representatives into significant committee positions, things of that nature, to force these major parties to make concessions in one way or another. Supporting a major party is supporting business as usual. And this is about as base as it gets. You know, this is the bumper sticker. Things won't change unless things change. But lastly, it's ultimately your choice. Voting for a third party is your right and has nothing to do with criticism aimed at you for doing so. If you voted for Jill Stein, you didn't vote for Donald Trump, right? That kind of idea. Boilerplate reasons not to vote third party. So these would be people, progressives, possibly people center of left, saying, I'm with you on 95% of what you're talking about. I understand your grievances about the Democratic Party. I share many of those too. However, this is reality. And that by voting third party, all that you're doing is hurting the closest thing that you have to representation in politics. Nationally speaking, voting for a third party is voting for an impossible scenario. It is truly throwing your vote away, meaning that, at least for now, the way in which we elect representatives, at least at the national scale, makes it virtually impossible for an electoral victory, for someone to be elevated to a federal position, whether it be executive or House or Senate. We'll get into why, but the idea that it's not just throwing your vote away because I don't like your party, it's throwing your vote away because it just structurally can't happen yet. And I've had this discussion to myself, again, being transparent, to where, you know, possibly third parties need to focus on electoral reform first before putting money into campaigns that are doomed for failure. Voting third party is the epitome of privilege. And what do I mean by that? So this is the idea that, look, upwards of 90% of African-American women, for instance, voted Democrat. And they vote Democrat because it is the lesser of evils and for harm reduction, as well as for other reasons, such as actual representation in that party. However, the idea that you're not going to vote for a Democrat and thereby potentially elevating a Republican to a position because you don't agree with a specific topic, whether it be foreign policy, Julian Assange, Medicare for all, right? These specific things, but 80% of the other stuff you do. That by doing that, what you're doing is essentially saying, I don't care about what the voter demographics are telling me. And that could be voter demographics for Hispanic, for Jewish voters, for all women except white women, all people, right? Essentially that are in any type of marginalized community, vote majority Democrat. And that you can argue that they shouldn't, and that you can argue why they shouldn't, but that by ignoring their voices and talking over them and condemning them, that this is essentially privilege. Because at the end of the day, regardless of what happens, if you look like me, the repercussions of a Donald Trump being elected are very minimal compared to other people in the society. Voting third party, regardless of rationalization, truly does help the opposing party. And this is one of those things that goes back and forth, and you can debate this all that you want. But one of the reasons that people say don't vote third party is, again, because structurally third parties cannot win, at least at a federal level in this argument. And that by default, since you're not voting for a Democrat who you mostly agree with, that you are throwing your vote away, or in other words, essentially giving by default Republicans a vote. The American system of governance, from election laws to congressional rules and procedures, are rooted in the two-party system. That this is, son, how it's always been, right? And that doesn't make it right, but it makes it true. That at least as everything is structured now, and I've kind of already talked about this, but it's the argument that, look, much like the British parliamentary system, it's not even necessarily presidential versus parliamentary, that the way that we set this thing up is just rooted historically, going all the way back to the second presidential election, when political parties kind of started forming, if we're talking about Democrat, Republicans, and Federalists. This is just how it's always been. Doesn't make it right, makes it true though. The lesser of two evils is a reality, and I discussed this, that arguing voting for a lesser of two evils is still voting for an evil, and having somebody say, yes, I know that. That's real life. Get out of your bubble. The world is not always great. As a matter of fact, this country is horribly racist and has horrible, horrible economic stratification. And that the history of this country, if we're talking about civil rights and things like that, is not stellar. And therefore, the lesser of those evils is the only thing that you can get out of this squalor. And so you do that and then advocate in other realms outside of electoralism, maybe as an activist, maybe in a nonprofit, maybe you volunteer, things like that. Hear what people are saying by viewing voter demographics. I already touched on that. Just pull up the voter demographics and you will see that there's a clear voice, and that people are telling you, regardless of what you say or regardless of what your friends say, this is what the majority of voters are saying. And the majority of voters who are not white men or women are saying, we need to vote Democrat to make sure that my family, that myself, and that my community is at least safe on the very, very basic levels against far-right reactionary politics. There's this discussion, and we already touched upon it, that voting for one person is actually voting for the other. And so, you know, here's maybe a more illustrative history of this. I remember all these elections in my lifetime. Although with Ross Perot, I was not old enough to vote. I'm not that old. But these are just some historical, modern historical examples of A for B. The idea that Bill Clinton fundamentally was assisted or helped by the presence of Ross Perot in his election against then President Bush number one. the idea, of course, Ralph Nader being much more infamous because of some of the narrow, thin margins, especially we all know about Florida. And if you don't, go check a video out on it. I'm sure that there will be still framed images of a man with glasses holding up a ballot like this and squinting to see if there is a hanging Chad, which became a cultural centerpiece for a few years in U.S. politics. And of course, more recently, Bernie Sanders. So it's interesting because all these folks are on different sides of the political spectrum. Some of them ran as third party, some of them did not. Some of them ran within a party, but maybe a different sector of that party. I'm thinking of Bernie Sanders, for instance, who's kind of been an independent, but ran as a Democrat, argued that he was bringing in new voices and even winning over some Republicans to the party, as opposed to someone like Ralph Nader, who in his presidential bid, the infamous presidential bid, was a Green Party candidate who made arguments kind of like Jill Stein. I don't really know about Howie Hawkins the last time around, but everything was so much more heightened with Trump and Clinton anyway, making these equivalency arguments that both parties are virtually the same on everything, so that you need a third party to enter into that discussion. So now what? Well, the goal for this video, again, is to understand opposing points of view, to have legitimate discussions, not just arguments, to objectively analyze institutional, legal, economic, and informal obstacles to third parties, to learn about election and campaign finance reform efforts, and I think lastly, to be honest about yourself. And what I mean by that is when we get to the interviews, especially of people who are giving their points of view, I approach these things with authenticity and curiosity and by listening instead of arguing and talking all the time. There are legitimate arguments on both sides. And I think that if we're engaging in this, we need to be honest with what it is we are doing. Are we legitimately concerned about the communities, the policies, the foreign policy, the things that we're tweeting about and putting on Facebook or Instagram, et cetera? Because it's very easy again, to sloganeer and say, end imperialism, and you'll get a lot of attention and a lot of people will like everything and it feels good. But in doing that, right, sloganeering or whatever you want to call it, what is it that you're truly accomplishing? Are you truly looking at the institutional, legal, economic, and informal obstacles to a third party, for instance? Or to flip that, if you're maybe a Democrat that's, saying, look at Jill Stein, she's in Moscow with Putin and the things that she's saying now about Ukraine. Are you listening to the grievances against the Democratic Party and saying, while I support the Democratic Party, what can I do to maybe address these things within my sphere of influence? Essentially, are you being authentic or are you just doing this to argue and have a hobby? And that's harder than I think most people want to admit. Politics has become a sport, and it's always kind of been that way, but with social media, it has definitely gone way that way. And people become very invested with their personal identities and the parasocial relationships that they've created. So are you truly invested in the things you're talking about? Or do you just agree with the things that you're talking about and you're invested in maybe boosting a tweet so that more people see it? Because it feels good when people are liking your stuff and people are trashing someone who disagrees with you in the comment section and you get that self-validation. What is it that you're really looking for in this? Is this a business model for you? Are you selling a Substack? Are you selling a monetized YouTube channel? Or are you really authentically concerned about the things in which you're saying you are? So now, moving past that introduction, can third parties win? And this is a big topic, right? So if you're going to go out there and trash Democrats, and it's easy, it's definitely something that is achievable and a goal that you can do and get self-validation for pretty quickly. But if you're going to go out there and say trash Democrats, right? How about some self-reflection and you know, can the third parties even win? So more on the Commission on Presidential Debates. The co-founders served as chairman for the Democratic National Committee and the Republican National Committee. So there is an argument to say, okay, this thing was set up by people who were engaged, active in the duopoly, let's say. And it's created these thresholds that I think they probably knew were impossible for a third party to break. And that's a little self-serving, isn't it? And, you know, this Commission on Presidential Debates is not part of the Constitution. It's not in any of the articles like the executive, the legislative branch, the judicial branch. This just is something that was made. And nowhere in the Constitution does it say it needs to be there. Since its initial founding, there have been no sitting officers from either major party involved in the organization. So let's be fair. Maybe they needed to set this up. And then since then, they said, look, we know that this is a conflict of interest. And so we're going to say that no sitting officers from either party can be involved. But this is one of the first things that we need to talk about if we're talking about third parties. Because again, most people aren't going to be as engaged in politics as probably the people watching this video even, but especially the folks that are really engaging hardcore on social media. And so they're going to get their stuff from mainstream media, and a lot of mainstream media gets their stuff from these debates. And there is essentially a blackout from anybody not in the Republican or Democratic Party. Here we are on the Commission on Presidential Debates website. And I'm on the mission page because I think that this is important to know too. The Commission on Presidential Debates was established in 1987 to ensure, for the benefit of the American electorate, that general election debates between or among the leading candidates for the offices of President and Vice President of the United States are a permanent part of the electoral process. And it goes on to talk about how, like this, the Commission on Presidential Debates, like how this is not in the Constitution, it's also true that down here, general election debates between the leading candidates are also not in the Constitution, meaning that these folks don't need to debate each other. There's nothing that says a president or a vice president needs to debate. Now, it's become part of our culture to do so. And it would be odd for a candidate to not do so. However, nowhere does it say that they have to do so. And this is the argument that the Commission on Presidential Debates makes for existing. So let's give the pro argument for this. The pro argument for this is that in the past, going back 50s, 60s, 70s, right? There weren't always consistent debates, televised debates. Folks didn't always know when these debates were going to happen per se. Sometimes the incumbent would wait until the last minute to have a debate so that there wasn't a lot of time to critique the debate, and that the existence of this organization is to ensure that citizens who are going to vote in the United States have an opportunity to see these debates occur, and that this is going to be a centralized nonprofit method to make that happen on behalf of the voting public for the benefit of the voting public. So that's the pro side to this commission existing. I'm going to go down here. Because then let's look at, you know, the negative side. So initially, well, we saw that this was set up by folks that were involved in the two major parties since then, the commission says that you can no longer participate if you are actively engaged in the party system. So fine, let's just say, okay, so they fixed that. I think another kind of knock on them would be debate sponsors, because ultimately this is going to be televised. And at the end of the day, this is going to make money, right? So who sponsors these? Well, on their page, at least, the 2016 AARP, the National Governors Association, but also Anheuser-Busch. 2012, again, Anheuser-Busch. I guess people are drinking beer, watching the Super Bowl and presidential debates. I don't know. But, you know, some interesting things, International Bottled Water Association. I don't know what that's about. But also Southwest Airlines. So why is Southwest Airlines, are they sponsoring this out of civic duty? Or are they sponsoring it to get their name up there and maybe throw some commercials in so that the audience flies with them? And so this is one of the many arguments about money involved in politics in the U.S. presidential system, of course. And I don't know, you know, it's a good populist message to say, look at this, why Anheuser-Busch is controlling our debates. You know, I could put that on Twitter and it would do very well. I could get a lot of likes, and, you know, the corporate duopoly is no interest in serving the public. Instead, they're there to make money off of corporations. As evidence, here is Anheuser-Busch sponsoring debates held by a private company or nonprofit that is not anywhere in the Constitution. And it's solely there to block third party voices and sell you beer. You know, that would be an argument that, yeah, I think a lot of people would be like, yeah. However, you know, another way to look at it is the reality is it's a nonprofit, but it needs money to be able to put this stuff together. And it's not going to just get money from private donors, which could also be problematic too, that it's not institutionalized in the system of government. So it's not going to get like tax money. It's not in the Constitution. So this is the reality. And unless you can prove to me that Southwest Airlines or Anheuser-Busch, unless you can prove it, if you can show me how they are somehow influencing this, then yeah, then maybe you have something. But until you do that, you just have a sloganeering correlation. Essentially, you need to prove causation, right? Another way to put it, just because it rains on Wednesday doesn't mean that Wednesday causes rain. And that's another way to look at it too. However, that's not going to do as well on social media, I can tell you that. And it isn't as if this organization has not been confronted, at least legally. So we have here the U.S. District Court of D.C., and we have our plaintiffs, Gary Johnson et al. Versus the Commission on Presidential Debates. So this was an argument that involved Gary Johnson as well as other third party folks saying that this is illegal, essentially, that they should be allowed to debate. This has happened before, but this is one of the more recent lawsuits, and I have here the opinion of that. So let's briefly look at the opinion. The Libertarian and Green parties and their political candidates sought and failed to receive invitations to privately sponsored presidential debates in 2012. They now seek invitations to this year's presidential debates, so that would be 2016, claiming the rules that bar their participation violate antitrust law. So this is interesting because, you know, you can't say that it's unconstitutional because there's nothing in the Constitution about this. So instead, what they're trying to say is that there's essentially a trust or like a monopoly of the political process between the two main parties. However, because plaintiffs have no standing and because antitrust laws govern commercial markets and not political activity, those claims fail as a matter of well-established law. Plaintiffs also allege violation of the First Amendment, freedom of speech, but those claims must be dismissed because the First Amendment guarantees freedom from government infringements, and defendants here are private parties. Finally, plaintiffs fail to allege facts that could support a claim for intentional interference with prospective business advantage. Defendants' motions to dismiss will be granted. So this went nowhere. And historically, these types of challenges have mostly gone nowhere as well on the federal level. However, there have been some successful challenges on the state level that we'll get to later. But this is specific to the Commission on Presidential Debates. Very clearly, an obstacle for third parties. Again, another argument in favor of this is that we can't just let everybody on stage. So that if we're going to say, okay, Mr. Gary Johnson, and at this time, you know, Ms. Jill Stein, we'll invite you. Well, then what about the Peace and Freedom Party? You know, what about all these other third parties? What criteria, because in an attempt to be objective, what criteria are you then using to say Gary Johnson can come, but not a candidate from this third party that, you know, only exists in New Mexico? This is fictitious. What criteria, or are you just saying this is purely subjective at this point, and there is no criteria? Because that would most likely, again, result in another lawsuit. So, you know, that's an argument as well, that the thresholds are established to only include people that can mathematically have an opportunity to win. So if Gary Johnson or Jill Stein at this period of time, for instance, if they aren't even on the ballot in enough states to have an electoral college victory, that there's no point in having them on these debates because they have no better chance of winning, even though they will have better vote outcomes than even further fringe third party that might consist of three people in their basement, right? The way that the math works out federally, at least. So more on can third parties win, Mr. Duverger's law. So this is a French political theorist, I suppose, who essentially said that success of third parties has less to do with people's willingness to vote, but more to do with the structure of their voting system. And here are some specifics. It holds that single ballot majoritarian elections with single member districts, such as first past the post, tend to favor a two-party system. First past the post means that the candidate who receives the most votes, even if less than 50%, wins everything, aka winner takes all. This favors a two-party system because third parties are not incentivized to form, and voters gravitate to one of the two major parties that has a much more realistic chance of winning. So lots of big words and independent words that are thrown together, but essentially it's saying that if you have something like the Electoral College, right? So we have states, and then we have districts in those states, and district reporting comes in, and then whoever of those candidates gets the most votes. It doesn't need to be the majority necessarily. It could be a plurality, but whoever gets the most wins all of the electoral votes for that state. And that the reality of that essentially makes it impossible for a third party to win. That third parties instead thrive in other systems in which it is not just majority take all, but is representative of the total breakdown of votes. And so, you know, maybe one party gets 30%, another party gets 35%, and I'm not going to do the math, but then there's two other parties that kind of split the rest, that within that structure, there can be representation taken from those different sections of the demographic. We're going to get into this specifically a little bit later when we talk about voting reform and things that are actually happening in the United States now with that. However, at a broader stepping back level, the idea that we have a winner-take-all system, again, at the federal level, at least in most states, and definitely with the Electoral College system, it makes it virtually impossible, structurally speaking, for a third party to win. We talked about can third parties win involving ballot access before, because it kind of touched on some of those thresholds to even get into a televised debate. So ballot access laws were one of the obstacles to accomplishing that. One of the major obstacles to third party viability is ballot access laws. Prohibitive ballot access laws make it difficult for third parties to even appear as an option on your ballot, much less on the TV. So why not change those laws, right? Because that seems like, well, okay, how about we change ballot access laws, allowing for more parties to possibly achieve electoral success, and then you don't need to sue or change a commission for debates. They would actually meet that threshold, this third party that we're making up, and they would have to be included then in you know, looking at their rules. So why not just change the laws? Well, it's not that easy, and here is why. Article 1, Section 4, Clause 1, Clause 1, Elections Clause. The times, places, and manner of holding elections for senators and representatives shall be prescribed in each state by the legislature thereof, but the Congress may at any time by law make or alter such regulations, except as to the places of choosing senators. What does this mean? There's more to it. The articles are really fun in the Constitution. People know all about the amendments, but they don't know so much about the articles. There's more to this, but what it's saying is this, that constitutionally speaking, it's up to the states to create their ballot laws, right? Ballot access laws. So why is this problematic for third parties? Because it is not as if a third party could try to bring to the Supreme Court, for instance, some type of lawsuit or appeal or something saying that they are unlawfully being excluded from ballots, and therefore there needs to be like a federal level change that would grant them access across the board. Instead, everything is, according to the Constitution, done at the state level. So you have a hodgepodge of different laws and ballot access thresholds, different wording, different rules in many, many, many of the states, which makes it, structurally speaking, very hard if we're going to talk about some type of ballot access reform, because you need to achieve this at the state level across the country. And it's going to be very hard to do so in any type of standardized way, because it's not as if New York or Massachusetts is about to agree with Texas or Oklahoma on this matter, or any matter for that being. And due to that, it's much more complicated, structurally speaking, for third parties to reform ballot access. It's really a state by state proposition. And the two parties do not make it easy when third parties try to address ballot access on the state level. There is a long history of both Republicans and Democrats doing everything that they can on different state levels to block access for third parties. Again, this is why it's so difficult and so complicated for a third party to say, look, we should be on the ballot. This is basic stuff. People should have the right to vote. We should be an option. Because what you're doing is essentially going through this on a state level, multiple lawsuits, multiple courts, multiple laws, multiple rules. And not only is it just a difficult task in general, this all takes money. And third parties just don't have the money that Republicans and Democrats have. So while some of these are overturned on the state level, it still makes it difficult. If anything, it's a win-win for Democrats and Republicans anyway, because even if something is overruled and the Green Party is allowed access to North Carolina, for instance, there's something along those lines, the amount of time, energy, money that goes into that accomplishment takes away from promoting a candidate, promoting policy, right? Doing all the things that you need to do to win, canvassing and getting all the stuff done to get the word out. But the better outcome for the two parties is, of course, that whatever state they're in agrees and says, yes, Green Party or Libertarian Party or, you know, whomever party, the modern Whig Party or what have you. You know, actually, the way that you got that signature, the dot on the I actually needed to be slightly to the right, and therefore your signature list is not valid. You know, that's an exaggeration, but things like that happen, and it makes it very difficult. So one, that means that if you're going to vote for a third party, in many states, you're going to have to write in that candidate. And that's just de facto making it impossible. Of course, it's feasible, but it's not going to realistically happen. But it's also blocking them from meeting an electoral college threshold, potentially, to get onto the debate stage to get their voices out to people who aren't digging through Twitter and learning about what third party candidates are doing, or all these little rules and things or lawsuits occurring in the background. They're never going to see these people, so they're not going to vote for them. Again, with third parties, can they win? It goes to this. Well, if we can't just change ballot access, because it's just complicated. It's at the state level. There's a lot going on. Why isn't proportional and winner take all discussed? Why don't we look at different ways of electing folks, maybe electoral reforms? So I stated proportional representation already. What does that mean? Because we talked about winner take all or first past the post. That's what we all know, right? So proportional representation is a little bit different. It's not one thing. It's as numerous forms of electoralism that result in subgroups of an electorate being reflected proportionally in the elected body. Party lists, single transferable vote, and mixed member proportional representation are some of the more popular versions of this. While these methods are used in various countries throughout the world, they have not been widely used in the United States. However, they have started to be used in certain areas of the United States. And it also helps describe some of the peculiar things that happen, maybe, let's say, like in European or Eastern European parliaments. When you're looking at some of the folks that are elected, you're like, hey, that guy is kind of like a Nazi. How did he get there? Well, you know, a knock on proportional representation, maybe on something like a party list, would be that you don't vote for the individual, right? You vote for the party list, and whomever's on there can be put into office. Those types of discussions can get very, very, very granular. We're not going to do that here. But there are arguments against proportional representation as well that are valid. I stated that this is kind of happening already in the United States. And so this is a great map or a series of maps that are showing what states are doing what in terms of trying to mix up the way in which we vote. So places that have adopted a voting system other than winner takes all. We have cumulative voting, and you know, it's interesting because this is happening everywhere from California to Texas, all the way up to the Northeast. We have limited voting and single non-transferable votes, some in Texas, but you know, the East, I suppose you could say, the Mississippi. Top two primary, top four primary, ranked voting choice, single transferable vote. So these are all different iterations of proportional voting, meaning that in one way or another, they are breaking apart this idea of winner take all, first past the post, and that if we go back to Duvalier's law, that this should hypothetically make it easier or more realistic for third parties to win in these states if we're changing the way in which we're voting. And here is what some of those things mean. So the source on the bottom, that goes for the maps as well that we just looked at. Types of voting systems based on how the general election winner or winners are chosen. So we have a plurality, a majoritarian, proportional, and semi-proportional. The plurality being what we know most of, right? First past the post, the winner takes all. Majoritarian, top two. So all candidates run against each other in the first round. Top two finishers meet in the second round. ranked choice voting. This is something that I feel like is discussed, that I see more on social media. Voters rank candidates by preference. If no candidate gets a majority, rankings are used to reallocate losers' votes until one does. Proportional single transferable vote. Voters rank the candidates. Once candidates receive a predetermined quota of votes, rankings are used to allocate seats either at large or in multi-member districts, and then semi-proportional, cumulative, limited, and single non-transferable votes. So these are all just different ideas or ways to introduce proportional voting to what we have traditionally seen in the United States, which is what you could call plurality, I suppose, but winner take all, which again fundamentally goes against, at least in some electoral science, goes against the opportunities for third parties to win. And then that moves us into campaign finance reform. Well, here's an interesting thing about that. You could potentially receive more pushback on this, because campaign finance reform could hypothetically or potentially hurt Democrats more than Republicans. Another way to flip this sentence around is that there is a world in which campaign finance reform actually helps Republicans more. So here's a graphic, and it shows major nonprofit groups aligned with the Democratic Party, and there's a very, very large number on top. And then under that, it shows major nonprofit groups aligned with the Republican Party, and there's another large number there too. However, you'll notice that the large number for Republicans is less than the large number for Democrats. And so even a progressive Democrat might argue, why would you want campaign finance reform when that is only going to help Republicans? Because again, third parties, for all the stuff we talked about already, it's assuming that they're not going to win, right? Like, let's get real, right? Your third party's not going to win. And the only result in reality is that you're helping Republicans by leveling the financial field, so that when we're talking about ads and all the things that political parties use money for, you're actually assisting Republicans with that, because you're taking away opportunities for Democrats to exceed Republicans in that part of the election. Citizens United. So what is Citizens United? It's a conservative nonprofit group called Citizens United that challenged campaign finance rules after the FEC stopped it from promoting and airing a film criticizing presidential candidate Hillary Clinton too close to presidential primaries. A 5-4 majority of the Supreme Court sided with Citizens United, ruling that corporations and other outside groups can spend unlimited amounts of money on elections. Well, you might see a lot about Citizens United on social media too, and why this, again, will hurt third parties, because third parties are not going to raise as much as the two major parties, even if you find some wealthy benefactor that's going to help, level that field. But let's talk about what Citizens United really means in terms of how it's being used, as opposed to how the courts framed it in terms of speech. In the court's opinion, Justice Anthony Kennedy wrote that limiting independent political spending from corporations and other groups, including unions, violates the First Amendment right to free speech. With its decision, the Supreme Court overturned election spending restrictions that date back more than 100 years. Previously, the court had held certain spending restrictions, arguing that the government had a role in this to prevent corruption. But in Citizens United, a bare majority of justices held that independent political spending did not present a threat of corruption, provided it was not coordinated with a candidate's campaign. So what the court said was this: if you are a political organization that is not officially part of the campaign, then there's no threat of corruption, meaning that you can raise as much money as you want because there's no conflict of interest, I suppose, in that you're not a part of the official campaign. What ended up happening, however, due to Citizens United, was the creation of super PACs, And they're not just packs, they are super duper super packs. So what's a super pack? A super political action committee, but it's not awesome. It's a special type of political action committee, which may raise unlimited sums of money from corporations, unions, and individuals, but is not permitted to contribute to or coordinate directly with parties or candidates. The difference? Traditional PACs have a cap on contributions, but thanks to Citizens United, super PACs do not. Citizens United struck down caps on independent spending by corporations and unions, reasoning that money that doesn't go directly to candidates can't pose any danger of corrupting them. Well, we're here to talk about third parties, not Citizens United, and the argument by the court. There is an argument about free speech. However, it's not necessarily included here, is it? And so those are some of the bigger parts. Now, there are many, many, many more. But you can see that whether it's from money, ballot access, access to debates, the structure of the voting system that we use, third parties have an uphill challenge when it comes to winning anything on the federal level. But there's more. There's more to third party obstacles. And it gets into what if they win? So what if all these things are overcome and that there is this messianic third party candidate who breaks through all these and wins, maybe without getting onto the debate stage, let's say, but somehow gets write-in votes on some states and gets on ballots in other states and wins the electoral college system and becomes president or conversely gets into the House of Representatives or the Senate. Then what? Could a third party representative even govern in the first place if they overcome all those things we talked about? Well, would a bill from the House of Representatives ever pass committee or be put on the legislative calendar to be voted for? This is a realistic argument, and it's one that is a downer that people don't want to talk about because you want to talk about abolish the electoral college system and the duopoly and things like this. But in both the House and the Senate, you have committees. And who makes those committees? The political parties. So who's in these committees? Republicans or Democrats, right? And if you want to bring something forward as a Green Party or a Libertarian or whomever, it needs to go through a committee. And so just practically speaking, you know, if you have one or two third party members in the House or the Senate, again, maybe being a little cynical, but practically speaking, what's the reality of whatever it is that they propose actually going through one of these committees and moving on to be voted on? Of course, that's another argument. When is it going to be put on the calendar? It could be put on the calendar the very, very last minute of the session, and we just kind of run out of time. You know, so there's a lot of informal ways, again, because the system is very much entrenched in the two-party system that's become an informal type of rule of governance in the United States. Even if somebody got to the legislative branch, unless there were a good quantity present, they're not going to be able to achieve much of anything, just based in reality. And it's a bummer, right? Doesn't mean you shouldn't vote for them, but this is just something that we need to practically talk about. Another thing could be, okay, well, if all the committees are, you know, based on Republicans and Democrats, then we need to get third party members into those committees. But again, those committees are made up of the majorities. And, you know, unless you have a third party somehow, you know, smash this two-party system amazingly and get all these representatives from all these different states, they're never going to be in a position to create these committees or staff these committees. And so they're never going to be a part of those committees. And if they're never a part of those committees, it's a long shot for whatever it is that they're proposing to really ever get through those committees. if somehow that happens, it still needs to get voted on and the president still needs to sign it. And who is the president? President's a member of one of these parties, unless we live in the magical hypothetical. I mean, just being realistic. Conversely, if you have a president that's independent or third party, how is he going to use his or her bully pulpit to advocate for policy when the legislative branch is made up of the two other parties? And you would hope that everyone would work together. But I think that maybe cynically, human nature and the nature of politics, we realize that budgets would get passed to continue funding so the lights don't go off, but there's going to be very little in terms of like what they ran on their plank or their policies that's going to get much attention. Maybe I'm being negative. You can disagree. Here is a nice graphic. Again, I just feel the hug of mom dropping me off so I can go to sleep in the back of the room. Especially if you grew up in a place where it's cold. If you go to school in a place that snows, there's nothing like having to wait for a school bus out in the snow and you get all the snow in your boots and you're just cold and you get into that room with the vents that have lead paint on them and it's just like 150 degrees in that room because they can't figure out how to regulate the temperature because the boiler room is from the colonial days or something. And you are just in that warm comfort and everything is melting off of you and you doze off to sleep thinking about morning cartoons, right? So here's a flow chart for how bills are drafted that probably existed somewhere laminated in a classroom that you attended. You have to look at this, and again, you have to say, if I vote for a third party person and they actually win, and we already talked about how difficult it is to win, are they going to be able to get a bill through this? Or no? And that's up for you to decide. It could also be that you don't care, that you, representation matters again, right? That you're just voting for a third party person just to get them there, just to have them speak and just be on TV and C-SPAN and stuff, just to have somebody up there, even though they really have no power in terms of committee or they're never really going to draft a bill that's going to go anywhere, but that they being there makes them an option for CNN to show or Fox News to show or MSNBC or clips that then go on to Twitter, right? So there's that argument to it as well, that you understand they're not really going to be able to implement what it is that they want to. However, that they being there in and of itself is important. That's an argument that you can make. If you know anything about my videos, you know that they run long. Some of them are upwards of 4 hours. And this is going to be a long one too, but it's going to be a long one in a different kind of way. This is going to be a long one because it's not going to be just me speaking. It's going to be other folks speaking. And so these are some folks that I've met on Twitter who are very politically active. One being here. Much more pro-Democrat, but still center of left. And here, being very, very, very third party orientated with, though, I think a good understanding of where people are coming from in terms of arguing on the Democrats' behalf. I'm not going to introduce these folks because they are going to introduce themselves in the discussion, which is coming up now.